WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. Tomorrow is the first anniversary of the fall of the Bosnian city Srebrenica. As the city fell, at least 4,000 Muslims were slaughtered by Bosnian Serbs. UN investigators have begun exhuming mass graves. Yesterday, New York Times reporter Chris Hedges was at the site of a mass grave. He's been based in Bosnia for the past year. He'll tell us what he saw yesterday, and we'll talk about the International War Crimes Tribunal, the upcoming election in Bosnia, and daily life in post-war Bosnia. Chris Hedges, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Hurricane warnings are now posted along the eastern seaboard as Hurricane Bertha churns closer to the southeastern United States. In Florida, a 500,000 residents have been ordered to evacuate coastal areas as the storm continues to pack top sustained winds of 105 miles per hour. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
Hurricane warnings have been issued from Sebastian Inlet in central Florida to Cape Romaine, South Carolina. In Florida, emergency operations officials have issued an evacuation order for coastal communities from Melbourne to Fernandina Beach. For the last 2 days, forecasters have predicted that Bertha would most likely not hit Florida, but instead make a gradual turn to the north. Bertha hasn't done that yet, but forecasters still expect it to do so. However, the question is, how much of an impact might Bertha have on Florida before it changes direction? Once that happens, forecasters say, Bertha will threaten North Carolina's Outer Banks, and officials there have ordered mandatory evacuations. In Miami, I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
President Clinton is scheduled to speak to the nation's oldest civil rights organization this hour. The NAACP convention is meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina. The group is concerned about the recent wave of church burnings. At a White House ceremony earlier today, the president praised bipartisan cooperation in Congress, which increased federal penalties for those accused of arson involving a church or synagogue. It also gives federal officials more power to prosecute people who attack church property, and it authorizes up to $10 million in loan guarantees to help rebuild churches. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel wants peace with its Arab neighbors. Speaking to a joint session of Congress this morning, the newly elected prime minister said he is ready to resume negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, as well as with Syria and Lebanon. Netanyahu also called on the United States to contain aggressive nations such as Iran and Iraq.
I believe the international community must reinvigorate its efforts to isolate these regimes and prevent them from acquiring atomic power. The United States and Israel have been at the forefront of this effort, but we can and we must do much more.
On the issue of Jerusalem, Netanyahu said he will never allow the city to be divided between Arabs and Jews. Dr. Jack Kevorkian has been involved in another suicide. An autopsy is being conducted on the body of a 39-year-old California woman who suffered from multiple sclerosis. Officials say Kevorkian brought the body to a Detroit hospital shortly after midnight. His attorney confirms Kevorkian helped the woman to end her life. Kevorkian has attended 33 deaths since 1990. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 31.75 points. It stands at 55.49. Trading is moderate. This is NPR News. Britain is sending another 1,000 troops to Northern Ireland. The worst street violence there in a decade broke out after police halted a Protestant march through a Catholic enclave. The violence began Sunday and sharply escalated today through much of the province. Police say 86 people have been injured in the violence, more than half of them police officers. The outbreak has disrupted plans for talks on the future of Northern Ireland. Authorities in the West African nation of Niger have banned public gatherings as tensions increase over preliminary election results. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Niger State Radio has declared military ruler Ibrahim Barry Manasora the winner of Sunday's vote with 52% of the ballot. But the country's four main opposition leaders have rejected those results as fraudulent. Their protests began when General Manasora suspended Niger's Independent Election Commission Monday and named his own. Since then, opposition leaders have been confined to their homes by state soldiers and have reportedly had their phone lines cut. The government banned demonstrations after a labor union announced it would strike. General Manasora took power in a coup last January. The move was well received as he vowed to end deadlock within the country's elected government. But critics say the general's handling of this week's election amounts to another coup d'etat. I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
For the first time, American troops are taking part in a land-based military exercise under a NATO banner. The exercise includes U.S., Latvian, Lithuanian, and Estonian troops. It begins today in the Baltic states and runs through July 18th under NATO's Partnership for Peace. Wildfires are burning in five western states today, but Utah's two West Desert fires are now about 60% contained. That's good news for people in the tiny desert town of Tara, where 28 homes were threatened. Those people have been evacuated, but now have been allowed to return home. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chris Hedges has spent the past year covering Bosnia for the New York Times. Earlier today, we called him in Belgrade. This is a significant moment in Bosnia's post-war life and in America's involvement in Bosnia. Elections are scheduled to go ahead in mid-September, in spite of the fact that two of the Bosnian Serb leaders who have been indicted by the International War Crimes Tribunal are still in power, political leader Radovan Karadzic and military leader General Ratko Mladic. Tomorrow, the tribunal will decide whether to issue international warrants for their arrests. U.S. forces are scheduled to pull out of Bosnia before the end of the year. Tomorrow is also the first anniversary of the fall of Srebrenica. UN forensic experts have begun exhuming the mass graves of Muslims who were slaughtered there. Chris Hedges was in Srebrenica yesterday. I asked him about the significance of the city's fall.
It really signaled the collapse of the whole UN peacekeeping operation in Bosnia and revealed the terrible contradictions that have plagued peacekeeping operations since the war began and, to a certain extent, even plagued the NATO-led peacekeeping operation that's currently in Bosnia.
Srebrenica had been designated a UN safe haven, and peacekeepers were there as the city fell and as thousands of Muslim men were slaughtered.
That's right. And this very dramatically revealed the inability of the UN to back up the kind of security arrangements that they had tried to map out in Bosnia. One of the things that a lot of people forget is that Sarajevo itself was designated as a safe haven, even though at this time last summer there were 900 shells coming in a day, 4 to 5 dead a day. But Srebrenica, of course, was the most dramatic and horrific example of this failing, because eventually anywhere from 4 to 7,000 Muslim men were taken away and killed.
You were in Srebrenica yesterday. Forensic experts are beginning to exhume mass graves there. What information are they looking for? I mean, obviously they're looking just for the bodies, but beyond that, what are they looking for?
Well, this is an effort directed by the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, and they will excavate or exhume bodies from 7 to 8 mass graves throughout Bosnia and probably even one in Croatia. Now, about 3 or 4 of those will be sites from the Srebrenica massacre. And what they're trying to do, this the grave that they are working on now, the site they're working on now, is holds victims from Srebrenica. And what they will try and do is determine the cause of death, determine as far as possible the identity of the people, the bodies they find in the graves, and then try and reconstruct what happened at the site and match it with reports from eyewitnesses. And this will be used in the prosecution against indicted war criminals, including, of course, the Bosnian Serb commander, General Ratko Mladic, and the Bosnian Serb leader, Radovan Karadzic.
Why is it important for forensic analysts to establish the specific cause of death in these massacres?
Because at this point, there are just a handful of eyewitnesses who survived the Srebrenica massacre. I think the correct number is 6, but certainly not more than 10. And these people are telling us stories, consistent stories, of the murder of thousands of people. So it's extremely important, if a case is to be built against the people, the Bosnian Serb leaders and commanders who directed this genocide, it's extremely important that there is evidence from the ground that can back up the kind of eyewitness testimony with the very small numbers of eyewitness testimony that has been collected so far. These investigations are vital for the War Crimes Tribunal's case against the Bosnian Serb leadership.
You were at one of the mass graves yesterday, the one that's being exhumed now. Would you describe what it's like at the site?
Yes, it's. I've been to several sites. This is the first site where I've been where they're actually exhuming. And like most of the other mass grave sites, it's not actually in Srebrenica. It's about 20 miles outside of Srebrenica. It's on a very lonely dirt road. Bodies are buried in a very shallow grave on an embankment along the side of the dirt road, about 100 foot length of the embankment. And on the opposite side of the road were dozens of shell casings. So the supposition is that these people, Muslims, were probably bussed or trucked into this remote location, lined up along the side of the road, and then gunned down by Bosnian Serb soldiers. They made very little attempt to hide the bodies. I mean, the layer of dirt is very shallow, and bodies are lined one right on top of the other.
It must be very gruesome to be there as the bodies are getting pulled out.
Yes, it's pretty sobering. You know, because the bodies were so close to the surface, there has been a fair bit of decay. I mean, they're not completely skeletal, but they're quickly approaching that because they're not very deep. But it's always sort of chilling, especially when you see the personal effects of boots, clothing, even, you know, bits of cards and IDs and things like that.
Chris Hedges is my guest, and he covered the war in the former Yugoslavia for the New York Times. Now he's covering post-war life there. General Ratko Mladic, the leader of the Bosnian Serb army, and Radovan Karadzic, the Bosnian Serb political leader, are both under indictment by the International War Crimes Tribunal for allegedly directing the massacres in Srebrenica and other massacres as well. And this week at the International War Crime Tribunal, a prosecutor called for international arrest warrants against these two leaders, and the tribunal will decide on that matter tomorrow. Why has it been so difficult to arrest them? There have already been warrants out for them.
Well, it isn't difficult to arrest them at all. This is a conscious decision by the commanders of NATO and Western political leaders, including President Clinton, not to arrest them. We all know where General Mladic is holed up, and we all know where Radovan Karadzic is holed up. Karadzic we can see occasionally in Pale. So there is no difficulty. There's a very concerted effort to avoid bumping into them. And the fear is, certainly among NATO commanders and many political leaders, is that with an arrest, this could spark retaliation, not only by the numerous bodyguards who protect both of these two men, but in the event of their capture by many of their followers. And this is something that the NATO commanders and the White House desperately want to avoid, especially as we come closer to elections.
How much power do Mladic and Karadzic have officially and unofficially?
Well, officially, General Mladic still commands the Bosnian Serb Army, and he has enormous power in terms of the military. He, the NATO commanders will receive faxes from him. They will receive telephone calls from him. The messages are transmitted through a translator. And Radovan Karadzic, of course, remains the head of the party. He has handed over some of his powers for dealing, primarily in terms of dealing with the international community, to his vice president. But since the international community won't talk to him anyway, this is sort of a mute point. These two men remain firmly in charge in Serb-held Bosnia.
The Dayton Accords forbid those who have been indicted by the War Crimes Tribunal to hold office. So their remaining in power is in direct defiance of the Dayton Accords. Is that really making the whole peace process questionable in the eyes of, say, Bosnians?
Very much so. And I think they have a point. If the goal is to create eventually an integrated Bosnia where at least the three ethnic leaderships, the Croats, the Muslims, and the Serbs, are speaking to each other, then I don't see how we can continue in a situation where Karadzic continues to control the 49% of Bosnian territory. There is a much more cynical view, and that is that both the architects of Dayton and the Western political leadership realize that the best they're going to get at this point is the partition of Bosnia, and there is probably no way to overcome that, and it's better just to live with the status quo rather than try and use coercion to change it.
Sounds like the peace process is very similar to the war in the respect that Karadzic and Mladic are, in a lot of ways, manipulating the international community.
And that's very true, and that's becoming increasingly evident as time goes on. We watched this whole process from the beginning in December, and when the Dayton Agreement was signed. And Karadzic and Mladic kept a very low profile, and they were very nervous. It all began to unravel with the handover of five Sarajevo suburbs and neighborhoods this spring. Admiral Leighton Smith cut a deal with the Bosnian Serb leadership that said that the Bosnian Serb policemen could remain, these were Serb neighborhoods and suburbs, in these areas beyond the scheduled turnover time if they respected the rules and regulations and laws of the federation, the nominal federation between the Muslims and the Croats. Well, they didn't do this. As everyone will remember, there was looting and arson and all sorts of incidents. People carted away truckloads of furniture. Admiral Smith permitted trucks to come in. And the NATO troops stood by and did nothing. This was a turning point. It was at this point that suddenly General Mladic appeared on the slopes of a local ski area Radovan Karadzic showed up in the city of Banja Luka giving speeches, and it's pretty much unraveled since then. We've had the incident of the, you know, the decision to go ahead with the elections, despite the fact that Karadzic is still there. And I think the Bosnian Serbs have woken up to the fact that the international community does not really have the stomach to go after them. And they're becoming increasingly defiant, as we've seen in the last few days when Karadzic was reappointed as the head of the party. The international community is, their bluff has been called. And that's what it's proven to be, a bluff.
Are Mladic and Karadzic heroes to Bosnian Serbs?
General Mladic is clearly a hero to the Bosnian Serbs. I would say that Karadzic's fortunes have changed. In December, he's clearly less popular. And in December, you heard widespread grumbling, even in Pale, the Serb, Bosnian Serb stronghold about 10 miles outside of Sarajevo. But as he has survived, as he has increasingly adopted this sort of in-your-face attitude to the Western community and gotten away with it, his stock has risen, ironically. And while he does not appear to enjoy the kind of following of General Mladic, he's clearly much more popular than he was in December. To a certain extent, both of these men are symbols. And the longer they are able to stand up to the array of forces that are against them, they garner more support on the ground from the Bosnian Serbs themselves.
Is there a propaganda machine that's justifying the actions of Mladic and Karadzic and of the Bosnian Serb position during the war?
Well, that's part of the problem, too, because Karadzic has an iron grip on all the radio and TV. I mean, there is no independent media in Serb-held Bosnia. And the television is, the Bosnian Serb television is just shameless. There was a report a few weeks ago, I mean, just to give you an example, that the experts from Belgrade had come down to Serb-held Bosnia and done a study of people, of Serbs, who had lived near areas where the NATO planes had come in and bombed last September. And this was, of course, the event that marked the turning point that brought about Dayton. And had found that NATO forces had used low levels of radiation and that people had been affected. This is just one of hundreds of fictitious stories that are pumped out over the airways by Karadzic and the Bosnian Serb leadership. These people, you know, the Bosnian Serbs, about 800,000 of them who live in this area, are completely isolated. They're completely cut off. They swallow, to an amazing extent, this propaganda.
My guest is Chris Hedges, and he covered the war in the former Yugoslavia for the New York Times, and now he's reporting on post-war life and politics. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Chris Hedges of the New York Times. He's been based in the former Yugoslavia for about a year. What's the range of opinion you've been running into about the elections, which are scheduled for mid-September?
Well, I think there's a feeling on all among all three parties, Croats, Muslims, and Serbs, that the elections are not going to change the political landscape of Bosnia. And I think begrudgingly, even the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe that is running the elections will admit this. These elections are important because they are designed to create a three-man presidency with a Croat, a Serb, and a Muslim, as well as a common parliament. And the international community has pinned its hopes that the creation of these multi-ethnic institutions will lead to the breaking down of these ethnic partitions and the creation of a unified and hopefully multi-ethnic Bosnia. The problem is that the conditions to hold elections that will give a voice to people who want to recreate a multi-ethnic society are not there. There's no freedom of movement. I mean, and this is a very important issue because take the town of Srebrenica, where you had the Muslims who were driven out or murdered last year. This town is now occupied by Serbs. Now, under the conditions of the elections, the Serbs, who control now the entire town, will be allowed to vote in Srebrenica, although virtually none of them are from Srebrenica. The Muslims, who were from Srebrenica, won't go back because the Serbs won't allow them to go back. There's been several incidents, violent incidents, where Muslims have tried to go back to visit graves or homes and just haven't been able to go. So we could see a situation, we probably will see a situation, where we hold the elections, the Muslims don't go back, the Serbs, who now form a majority, although they're not originally from Srebrenica, vote, and Srebrenica becomes a Serb town. That's one example of how we will solidify this kind of partition through the elections, because the preconditions for elections, freedom of movement, freedom of press, the right of political parties to campaign freely, is not there.
The international community has decided that elections should proceed as scheduled in September, in spite of violations of the Dayton Accords. Is there a lot of popular feeling within the former Yugoslavia that elections should be held up until everybody comes more into compliance with the Dayton Accords and there's more freedom of movement?
Well, I think that that's certainly the feeling of the Muslim leadership, because they realize very well that if elections go ahead under the current conditions, the ethnic, the Croat and Serb ethnic leadership that prosecuted this war, that have fought against and in large part contributed to the destruction of a multi-ethnic society in Bosnia, will retain power. And with people like Radovan Karadzic in power, it's just going to be impossible to move forward. Even if Karadzic is not officially the president from the elections, as long as he still pulls all the strings, we're not going to make any progress.
Chris Hedges of the New York Times. He's been covering Bosnia for the past year. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, life in post-war Bosnia and why hopes for a multi-ethnic society are becoming increasingly dim. We continue our conversation with Chris Hedges of The New York Times. He'll also look back on his past year covering Bosnia for The Times. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second half of our interview with Chris Hedges of The New York Times. He's been based in Bosnia for the past year. He covered the end of the war and is now covering post-war life and politics. Bosnian elections are scheduled for September, and NATO troops are scheduled to begin pulling out in December. We called Hedges in Belgrade earlier today. What are the feelings now in Bosnia toward the international community that's overseeing the peace process?
The Muslim leadership is clearly and quite vocally disappointed. You know, they realize that this is the last chance. The NATO forces are scheduled to begin withdrawing on December 20th. And we're running out of time, if we haven't already run out of time, to try and knit Bosnia back together. Because the NATO forces and especially the American military leadership has been so excessively cautious, they have on the one hand, of course, done a good job of keeping the troops safe, but by not risking anything, they haven't really done anything other than establish ceasefire lines. In that sense, it's very much like Cyprus. The very lofty and laudable goals of Dayton, are not met because the NATO forces just won't back them up. And the Muslim leadership realizes very well that if Bosnia breaks up into three entities, one of which is Croat, which has been already virtually absorbed by the Croatian state, you know, they use the kuna, they wave the Croatian flag. It's a local call from West Mostar to Zagreb. Pictures of President Tuđman all over the place, the Croatian president. And you have the same phenomena happening in Serb-held Bosnia. You're going to be left with this tiny Muslim ghetto. in 30% of Bosnia, surrounded by people who hate them and who don't want them to exist. And I think it is going to be economically and politically very difficult for the Muslims to make a go of it. I just don't think it's viable, and they know that. So they realize that if the international community and NATO pulls out of here, it begins to pull out of here at the end of the year, and everything remains the same, and it looks like that's going to happen, their long-term chances of survival are very poor.
What do you mean when you say survival?
Well, you know, if you take Muslim-held Bosnia, or the Muslim-led government, because there is some small Serb representation in it, you have 80% unemployment. I remember I was in Sarajevo, and there used to be a Volkswagen plant there, a large one. And I remember when the Volkswagen officials came to look at the plant, which is devastated, and they just walked away. There's not even a basis. You just have to build an entire new plant. There's nothing left, and that's emblematic of the way the whole state is. If you know Muslims can't travel freely, there's still harassment. There's very poor cooperation with neighboring with Serbia and Croatia because of this kind of hostility. The place is going to be ripe for demagogues. You already see an increasing Islamization of the society. And coming from the Middle East, I find these signs very worrying. This is not a Muslim fundamentalist state by any means. There's still, a rich sort of cultural diversity and depth in places like Sarajevo, but this will be diminished. Given the array of political and economic forces that are at this point set up against the Muslim-led government, and I think that in the years ahead, we're sort of destined to see renewed conflict of one kind or another.
What are some of the signs of the growing culture of Islamic fundamentalism that you see in Sarajevo? Did you mean Sarajevo specifically?
More Bosnia itself. I mean, Sarajevo, you see it. You see it most of all, of course, in the ruling party. President Ali Izetbegovic has a close relationship with Iran. Iran has proven, unlike the West, to be a consistent and reliable ally. Despite the gloss that American officials put over it, Islamic fighters and Iranian fighters are known as Mujahideen, as well as Iranian intelligence operatives have not left Bosnia. They're still there. They're quiet. They're keeping a low profile, but they're not gone. And there's there are very close ties between many of these Muslim fundamentalists, Mujahideen, and the military, as well as the party. You also see in smaller towns, I find that they've focused on towns often that are in the areas around Sarajevo rather than Sarajevo itself, where they the political leadership has become Islamic. They banned alcohol. You walk into the city hall in towns like Tarchin, and all the women are wearing headscarves. There is a very quiet but diligent campaign. And as people, there is already a certain, and I think with a great deal of justification, a certain feeling that the West has not proven to be a reliable ally. As time goes on, as jobs are not created, as the West proves that it doesn't have the spine or the backbone to carry out the things that it says it wants to do, the agenda of the Islamic militants and of Iran becomes increasingly attractive.
My guest is Chris Hedges of the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Chris Hedges is my guest. He's been reporting from Bosnia for the past year for the New York Times. Sarajevo was celebrated as a multicultural city before the war. How multicultural is it now?
Much less so. Now, you know, there are several reasons for that, but one of the most important is that most of, perhaps even two-thirds of the original population no longer lives there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very disturbing decision last December by the parliament to pass through a law, a housing law, property law, that said that anyone who had left, Muslim, Serb, Croat, who had left the city and did not come back within 7 days if they were still within Bosnia, and I believe it was 2 weeks if they were outside Bosnia. This was not a law that, by the way, that received any publicity, would lose their apartments. Now, it did affect Muslims who had left the city and were not able to get back, and most people were not. But most of the people who left Sarajevo at the beginning of the war were Serbs and Croats. And we have seen a phenomenon this spring where Serbian families wanted to come back to Sarajevo and found that Muslims, usually Muslim military, had been given their apartments, Muslim officers. And under the law, they were not allowed to get back in, and they were locked out. So we had a situation where there was a diverse city, large numbers of people left. The people who want to come back and recreate this diverse city are being kept out by the Muslim government in Sarajevo. And this, coupled with the fact that you had 50,000 Serbs flee five neighborhoods and suburbs around the city this spring when they were handed over to the Muslim government, is rapidly changing the character, because we had a large inflow of refugees, well over 150,000 during the war from the countryside, where people came from villages that were controlled only by Muslims. I mean, you know, there's a myth that Bosnia itself was multi-ethnic, and that's not really true. The urban centers like Sarajevo, Mostar, Tuzla were. But when you go into these valleys, it's quite striking because each village had its own ethnic composition. You had the Serb village and the Muslim village and the Croat village, and very rarely did they mix. So you're bringing people from the countryside who didn't mix, who are not used to this tradition, often poorly educated, and Sarajevo as a city is radically different from what it was before the war. And because of this property law and because of the orientation of the government, I think it's going to be very difficult to rebuild a real multi-ethnic urban center, which, of course, is vital if you're going to rebuild a multi-ethnic Bosnia.
So this government law that's preventing Croats and Serbs from reclaiming the apartments that they left during the war, was that designed just to favor the people who stayed in Sarajevo during the war, or is it designed to punish other ethnic groups?
Well, when I spoke to the government housing authority, they said that this law was designed to reward or assist those families that lived throughout the war in the city, and that if other families had left and had other places to live, then they already had a place to live. I mean, there is a terrible housing shortage in Bosnia, with a number of villages and apartments in cities that have been destroyed. You're sort of cramming refugee families or displaced families into apartments, so that there is some legitimacy. That's the public stance, but I think they're very conscious of what they're doing, and I think there is an effort, although it's unspoken, to make Sarajevo a Muslim city.
Is Sarajevo still a shell-shocked city? Are people still walking around in that almost deadened state that people seem to have fallen into during the war?
No. In the sense that the city has a certain life to it that it didn't have. You have outdoor cafes. restaurants, people walk. But I still find Sarajevo to be, despite the outward changes, the people who live in Sarajevo to be deeply scarred and affected by the war. It's certainly an incredibly depressing place to live, not only because of the vast physical destruction, the number of buildings that have been pummeled by artillery and the ruins, but the people who lived through that were so beaten down. The emotional scars are so deep that I think it's going to be probably a generation before people are able to shake that. I find it a city that it's not a pleasant place to be. It's not the weight of the war, the weight of what happened still weighs so heavily. And also you have to remember that, you know, almost everybody in that city lost family members or close friends. The numbers of dead, because of the high number of people who were killed or wounded, everybody was touched and affected by the war. And there's still, that has generated a lot of hatred and a lot of bitterness, coupled with, you know, what's happening now with the NATO peacekeeping forces. People realize that once again, they've, to a certain extent, been sold a bill of goods. They signed on to the Dayton Agreement because they were told, and to a large extent they believed, that this was going to rebuild a Bosnia where they could have a life. And I think they're beginning to wake up to the fact that this is not true.
The war is over, but I'm wondering how safe the city is now, safe from criminals.
Well, I think, you know, one of the impressive things about the Muslim government is to the extent that they managed to create a system that was relatively honest and relatively secure. You know, you go to a city like Mostar, and it's in the grip of two large criminal gangs. It's, you know, there's stolen cars everywhere. The crime is horrendous. There are shootouts. And that's not true in Sarajevo. There is, of course, petty crime. There is car theft. But not violent crime. It's not really a dangerous place. And I think, to that extent, the credit has to be given to the government. When I'm stopped at a checkpoint, I feel very differently if that checkpoint is run by Serb policemen, Bosnian Serb policemen, or Muslim policemen, and almost without exception. And I don't think it's just because I'm clearly not a Bosnian. They have done a pretty good job of creating, under terrible conditions, a civil society, and that's certainly not true in Serb-held Bosnia or in the Croatian part of Bosnia. Their police are often drink and are there to take with whatever they have, and if that includes your car, that's fine.
So what's the worst thing that's been happening to you lately at checkpoints?
All my bad experience have been with the Bosnian Serbs. I had a colleague from the Los Angeles Times who, outside of Pale, lost his Mercedes Jeep at gunpoint, and there have been other colleagues who've experienced the same. I fortunately have not lost a vehicle. I get stopped and shaken down and asked for money, things like that, cigarettes, or it's all relatively minor, but it's, you know, it can always go either way, and so it's tense.
Do you carry things with you expressly for the purpose of giving it to people when they shake you down?
Yes, always.
What works the best?
Cigarettes and this horrible rot gut called Stock that everybody drinks, Stock 88. It's a very cheap brandy. So I always have a few bottles of those.
How easy is it for you to get around now? You've been doing a lot of traveling.
I still get around quite a bit. I'm a fish. I'm a fish. I've been expelled from the Republic of Srpska and banned. But I still go anyway, and I managed to sort of bluff my way through, including my trip yesterday to Srebrenica. It wasn't an authorized trip. I'm still impressed with how much we can travel around. It's not always comfortable, and it's sometimes can be a little nerve-wracking. But everybody's still so off balance. And, you know, once we got into the Srebrenica area, we had a large number of American troops who were guarding the mass grave sites, or maybe they don't like the word guarding, but they were positioned around the mass grave sites. And this kind of show of force is very effective, especially if you're an American reporter, for sort of calming the Bosnian Serbs down to the extent where they may block you from going into a place. But the kind of horrible and often even physical harassment that we saw before the arrival of the NATO troops has not been prevalent or very common.
How do you bluff your way into an area from which you've been banned?
Well, part of it's just sort of walking around with a confidence that you belong there even when you don't. I try and avoid, I avoid certain cities where I know that, like for instance, Zvornik is a Bosnian Serb city controlled by hardliners, and the chief of police there is a real nasty character. I will, as I did yesterday, add another 45 minutes to my drive to skirt it, to go around it. So part of it's knowing which areas not to go in. I try not to drive too much at night. Of course, I always travel with a translator. My translator is a Serb, and a lot of it is sort of when you reach a checkpoint, being very friendly, very casual, never in a hurry to get through. I think those are sort of the tips. I mean, checkpoints are sort of funny things to negotiate. You always, the moment you arrive, there's always a great deal of hostility, and you often have to devote a lot of time and energy to breaking that down.
My guest is Chris Hedges of the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us by phone from Belgrade is Chris Hedges of the New York Times. You've been reporting from Bosnia for about a year now. Do you have a mental cutoff point for when you'll want to leave?
That's a good question. I don't know that I'd want to. If the war broke out again, I don't know. I'd have to really think about it. This was a pretty brutal, horrible conflict. I don't think that the war necessarily will break out again. Like any story, it takes a long time to build up the contacts, to build up the background, to build up the knowledge. It's been a year, a little over a year. I'm thinking now for a couple more years. But you know, it's funny in this business. You often reach a point where you suddenly realize it's time to go. And you can't always predict when that will happen. There's an emotional and a sort of intellectual exhaustion that descends on you. And that can be caused by incidents that are far beyond your control. I remember covering the war in Salvador, and it was just one more colleague who got killed. It became pretty hard to get in the Jeep and go back out. So in some ways, you're a victim of the circumstances and events around you, and you can't predict that.
You've been in Bosnia for about a year, and tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of the fall of Srebrenica. Can I just ask you for some of your reflections looking back on this past year? I figure this must be a time for reflection for you.
Yes. Yeah. You know, the whole thing with Srebrenica, it's one of these horrific, just horrific crimes. When I think about it now, a year ago I was in Sarajevo, covering it from Sarajevo. None of us were in Srebrenica. And I, you know, now that it's put into historical perspective, it's certainly the worst atrocity that's been committed in Europe since the Second World War. And at the time, we realized something was horribly wrong. We were getting reports from UN officials who were in Srebrenica, who were speaking by radio with people from Sarajevo. That's primarily how we got our information. In retrospect, they did a very good job of telling us the truth, even though this was a horrible, horrible failure for the UN, not only for the UN operation in Srebrenica, but for the entire UN operation in Bosnia. But to their credit, the officials in Sarajevo were honest, pretty honest and pretty frank. And I think at the time, when I look back, I didn't realize how important it was. I didn't realize, you know, and it bothers me that I didn't, that the horrible scale of the atrocity, the impact of that, didn't really hit home to me at the time. Of course, you know, it took a while for us to realize that the numbers were that high, that, you know, we may be probably talking about certainly several thousand, maybe as many as 7,000 executed. And I think that that's the one feeling I have. And the other, as I, you know, spend the year watching the West once again bumble its way through Bosnia, I feel that there's such a terrible paucity of good leadership, that, you know, nobody, you know, whether it's John Major or Bill Clinton or anybody else, is willing to take risks, is willing to gamble much. And this kind of insistence on safety and on caution is one that will perhaps allow the NATO forces and the international community to extract itself from the conflict, but will do nothing to solve it. And I think those are my two feelings and two things that I think a lot about and that upset me.
Chris Hedges, thank you very much for talking with us.
No, thank you, Terry.
Chris Hedges covers Bosnia for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Belgrade. Our conversation was recorded earlier today. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. We have production assistants from Phoebe Vanskoy. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Well, I'm about to record an interview with Willie Nelson, which we expect to broadcast next week. He has two new CDs. We'll close with a track from his new album of gospel songs called How Great Thou Art. His sister Bobby Nelson is at the piano.
I looked over Jordan and what did I see? Coming for to carry me home. A band of angels coming after me. Coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot. Coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot. Coming for to carry me home. And if you get there before I do, coming for to carry me home. Tell all my friends I'm coming too. Coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot. Coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Well, I'm sometimes up, and I'm sometimes woman for to carry me home. But still my soul feels heavenward bound. A man for to carry me home. Sway low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.